Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And here we are with Faust Part 2, Act 3, in which Daniel and I make much of a little. The act may be short, but there's a lot to say with a long digression on Byron. The Cannonball is a member of the Agora Podcast Network, and as part of our embrace of all things creepy in the month of October, the network has pooled its talent to produce a set of spooky episodes under the heading of Agoraphobia. In the show notes, there's a link to the first episode, which features two Celtic-themed horrors with Ben Jacobs from Wittenberg to Westphalia talking on the Highland clearances, and Sam Hume of Pax Britannica walking us through the Buggane. And if you're a fan of our show, you can check out our discussion of Ambrose Bierce and the origins of weird fiction. There's another link in the show notes to that. And on episode 3, Raven from Tiny Vampires gets buggy with it, and I offer a maybe too personal meditation on monsters in the Spanish Baroque. And there's another link in the show notes for that. There are going to be upcoming episodes from others in the Agora roster, so subscribe and listen and enjoy some not unreasonably researched chills. If you're online, check us out at thecannonballpodcast.wordpress.com. Find us on Facebook at The Cannonball Podcast and on Twitter at Cannonball Pod. And if you enjoy the show, please rate and review wherever you listen. Welcome to The Cannonball, a podcast attempt to read all of the books in Harold Bloom's list of the Western canon. This is Claude Myron Guzer, and with me as always is my co-host, Daniel Doherty. Daniel, how you doing, man?
Hey, I am on the verge of just physical incapacitation right now. I made the mistake of attempting to start a new exercise regimen after months of just kind of COVID lapse. And it's been 2 days. It's been two full days. It's been 48 hours since I did a mild, like, workout routine that I also sandbagged on. And my muscles are still yelling at me. And then also, I ate a tremendous amount of takeout tonight. So I am basically, you know, just don't ask me to do anything physical, but I am absolutely ready for the to embrace the battlefield of the mind that we the gladiatorial arena of thoughts and opinion that we that we have created here. So yeah,
I was just waiting to see how you were going to stretch that one out, like how you're going to get that to land.
The trick is to not bother sticking the landing, I find.
In any case, I guess we're sort of vamping a little bit, and I suppose this episode might be a lot of vamping. We'll see how it goes. The fact of the matter is that Act 3 of Part 2 of Faust, which is what we're here to talk about, is kind of the centerpiece of the whole play, or it was originally intended as the centerpiece of Faust Part 2. But it's really pretty brief.
As far as things go, it's just sort of you're in, you're out. It's three scenes, each one more or less self-contained. And, you know, last time we were at this, we were doing Act Two, which is just, I mean, it is a splendid monument of clusterfuckery.
Yes, yes. This was refreshingly straightforward for all of the slipperiness and Goethe-ness that you find in it. After the classical Walpurgis Nacht, I mean, God, a scene where human beings talk to each other was it's just incredible.
There's a novelty to three people just having a conversation, but that was the thing. Part of what we sometimes get away from is our affective response to this, and you know, as wild and just bananas as the classical Walpurgis Nacht was, that was sort of what was appealing about it.
Yeah,
just the variations, permutations, the weird pageantry, the really the spectacle of it.
Yeah,
you know, and there's something. It's sort of like it's a little deflating to go from that to something as straightforward as Act Three. Now, this is kind of the thesis of the play. This is the act that's the thesis of the play. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of shockingly, disarmingly straightforward. And there's, as I sort of said, it was a little bit of a letdown.
Yeah.
Or at
yeah.
least it was for me. I don't know about you.
No, I feel the same way. It had the same kind of like it sort of felt like I understand that with the classical Walpurgis Nacht, you kind of like – you reach a point where you can't take it much further. So I knew that that Goethe was going to have to dial it back a bit. But it was a little deflated. You know, it was kind of like a – well, I don't know. I guess we'll discover that more, dear listener, as we talk about it, as Claude lays out what's going on here. But the retreat to much more familiar ground, even with the classical references, was kind of like a little, a step away from the heady days of like referencing things that I had never even heard of in my, 20, 30 years of being interested in Hellenic society,
Well, we still get our tragic cosmic ejaculatory ending, but
yes, we do. I noted very much some parallels that crop up.
Yeah, but it's made a little bit more tragic because it involves Byron dying.
I see.
That's its own weird thing, which I guess we'll get into. I suppose if we're messing about in Faust Part Two, you can't get away from Goethe's, I guess, flagrant messy sexuality, like the stickiness is sort of all over it, on purpose. Like again, as we were talking about last time, he has a sort of larger point with, the sort of messy sex that goes on or the sort of weird ejaculatory stuff that goes on. It's not just thrown in there to sort of insult good taste or anything like that. And I really don't think Faust Part Two is insulting good taste all that much. Maybe the way I'm presenting it is insulting to good taste, but I didn't find it insulting to good taste. But it's not that he's throwing it in as a sort of Howard Stern gesture. It's that he's weaving it in as part of the Faustian drive. I mean, the Faustian drive is connected to sexuality and it has been since the beginning, like since Faust Part One. But here it's sort of like he seems to be examining the culmination, and the culmination is problematic. It's always deflating in some way, shape, or form, or it has a kind of gesture towards finality or ending, which is a letdown.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. But
absolutely.
But Byron dies. But before we can get to that, we have to sort of understand what Act Three is all about. And Act Three was originally intended as the centerpiece to the play, to Faust Part II. Mm-hmm. I believe I talked about this with my friend Rachel in the episode we aired, sort of like the background information. And then we talked about it with when we were talking about the construction of Faust Part II. He wrote it in bits and pieces over the course of a couple of decades. Mm-hmm. And Act Three was supposed to be the centerpiece because, well, all right, I'll tell you the original title. This was a fragment called Helen in the Middle Ages, a satiric drama.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And satiric as in S-A-T-Y-R, satyr.
Yeah. Yeah.
The satyr plays were, in case you're unfamiliar, not necessarily you, but anyone in the audience, the satyr plays were sort of the fourth part of a classical Greek trilogy. So what they would do with the tragedies is during the dramatic competition, you would have a trilogy concerning one particular, set of characters or one particular house, one particular what have you, or one particular myth. And it would end in a kind of semi-triumph of some sort. But after all the horror and nastiness and high drama and bad feelings that accompany high drama, you'd have a satyr play. And it was sort of like a bawdy little, let's, you know, cheer ourselves up a little bit with something that's reflective in some way, shape, or form of the trilogy that you just witnessed, but mm-hmm. sort of burlesques it.
Yeah.
And if you've never read Greek comedy, it was pretty gnarly.
They played it blue and they played it broad.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. So, at the end of all this stuff, you get like naked Three Stooges grabbing each other's crotch and stuff like that. That's not actually what happened, but I'm just trying to give you a sort of feel for the vibe,
you know.
So anyway, to call it a satiric drama mm-hmm. is kind of this weird – it's a mixture of genres. Or it strikes me as a mixture of genres. And that's what's going on in Faust Part II. Anyway, it's drama, but it's epic drama. And it's this weird kind of hybrid of everything. And as I believe we talked about before, it's sort of a pastiche. Mm-hmm. That's what my friend Rachel kept sort of articulating to me, is that this is a pastiche of all these other things, and he just sort of picks and chooses and throws things together just to see how they intermix. But the idea is that this is Helen in the Middle Ages. What he's sort of trying to do here, what the original intent was to take classicism and wed it, like ancient Greek or I guess classical Greek mm-hmm. classicism, and wed it to a kind of high European mindset to mm-hmm. come out with the best of both worlds, to create this kind of hybrid project to apply the classical to this other place and time, to try to produce a kind of renewed modern classicism. So it's got this kind of nationalist project sort of built into it. Mm-hmm. But the thing that sort of hits me more is how this is a project to merge antiquity and modernity, to take the best of one age, meld it with another age, and sort of see what happens, produce this kind of hybrid form.
Yeah.
And I might just be reading this too much through the lens of Hart Crane. Crane did a poem on this very theme, the marriage of Faustus and Helen, where, in opposition to something like T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound's gloomy paleo modernism, Crane had a much more hopeful, like a more hopeful view, I suppose, which is ironic because he was producing much of what he was producing in the middle of the Great Depression. But he had this sort of more hopeful view of what the modern could produce. It could be something that with certain kinds of refinement could be, you know, so on and so forth. But Hart Crane didn't really sort of live to see that project through. And there's a real question in my mind about where Goethe thinks this goes, because this act is also representative in some ways of his attempts to bring classicism to Germany, Weimar classicism. And there seems to be an ambivalence about whether or not that can be achieved or how effective that was. I mean, we've come across this before, like in Act One, where you had the pageantry and you had the spectacle, and there was this sort of attempt to bring art to the masses. And when Faust started producing The Shades of Helen, nobody thought it was that special. So here's where he's doing it. And does it work? That's kind of the question.
Yeah.
So the second title for it was, later on he revised this episode and he called it a classical romantic phantasmagoria.
Okay.
Which that seems more
on point. I was going to say, that's closer to what I read.
Yeah. But it still contains pieces – excuse me, I'm drinking my water. It still contains pieces of those – hybrids, right? It's classical romantic, and it's a phantasmagoria. This act sort of famously starts out in the Greek tragic form, like using the verse form of Greek tragedy, like the actual meter. And then slowly it shifts into the kind of plurality of European metrics that Goethe has been playing with all along. So it slides from one sort of verse form into another. And that seems to be how he's thinking about modern innovation meeting, I guess, classical refinement.
So
that seems to me an interesting move. Unfortunately, we're reading this in translation, and I really feel like I'm missing a lot, be that as it may. So the act spans about 1,000 years.
Yeah,
There's – Helen goes from Menelaus's palace to this, I guess, German outpost within the course of a couple of lines.
Yeah, which is explained to her. So there's a kind of monstrous steward of Menelaus's palace who is – I thought this was kind of interesting. I was – the first thing that really – like caught my notice here is that so Helen comes back home with a coterie of Trojan women who serve as her maids that are now refugees from their leveled home. Proud towers of Ilium have been cast down and Helen's back in Sparta. And so she's confronted with this warden, supposedly, who's been taking care of the palace, you know, since she's been gone. And is like they're supposed to lay out all of the accoutrement for a sacrifice, you know, which would not have been, you know, unusual for kind of like, oh, we're going to give thanks to the gods that we made it back home. So they're going to get like the, we need all the, you know, the incense burners and the holy vessels for the water to cleanse our, you know, blood clotted hands and all that stuff. But Helen notices that, nowhere in these instructions does it call for us to bring an animal in. Huh. Wonder what that's about.
So, I mean, yeah, that's the thing, is that the first this act is in three scenes, and the first scene really does play on I mean it's a pretty effective reimagining of a Greek tragedy. Mm-hmm. It's playing on the sort of tragedies of homecoming. And if anything, it reminded me a whole lot of Agamemnon.
You familiar with that? Agamemnon? And that was my first thought, was like, my immediate thought was like, oh, wait a minute. Am I remembering all my Homeric stuff wrong? I don't think Helen got sacrificed when she got back home. Is there a version of it that does it? So I went and I consulted my, I consulted my copy of, the Greek myths by the, as told by Robert Graves, which, by the way, just as a caveat here, Robert Graves did a wonderful job of retelling various myths and their various versions, his interpretation of what those myths mean. Pretty much gobbledygook. Don't go with that. But as actual retellings, I think they're great, and that's why I hold on to my copy. I was looking for some kind of mention of like Helen getting getting sacrificed, and I was like, okay, this isn't me. I did not flub this, as I do so many things. Goethe has invented something here. Interesting.
But it does. I mean, it really does play like Agamemnon, and if any of the listeners haven't read Agamemnon, or it's been a long, long time. Agamemnon was the brother of Menelaus, who was the one who kind of rallied the troops to get them all out to Troy. He got everybody together, but they couldn't get the breeze up. They couldn't get a wind to get out of port. So he had to sacrifice his daughter Iphigenia to the gods to get a good wind. Mm-hmm. And that didn't really put him in a good footing with his, or on a good footing with his wife. So Clytemnestra sort of held that against him, you know, like you do. So he goes out to Troy. They conquer Troy. He comes back with Cassandra, who's this Trojan woman who has been blessed with the gift of second sight, but also cursed because no one will believe her.
Right.
So she comes back, or she comes back with him. Agamemnon comes home. They roll out the purple carpet. He's not supposed to step on the purple carpet, but does anyway. And then he goes home to a bath, and that's where Cassandra sort of articulates all the violence that's gonna happen. Cassandra sees Agamemnon being slaughtered in his bath by Clytemnestra and her lover, whom she has taken during the meanwhile. And Cassandra even sees that she will be murdered in the same way with an axe, and there's nothing she can do about it. It all comes to pass, and Clytemnestra comes back on stage after having slaughtered everybody, her hands bloody, and she says, "Hey, I'm the ruler in town. My boyfriend's going to be king. Everybody shut up and do what you're told." The end, until her son, Orestes, in the next play, comes back to kill his mother. Like you do.
Right.
Anyway, that's Agamemnon is actually a really, if anybody's looking for something good and creepy and bone chilling to read in the month of October, which is when we're recording this, and I'm assuming it's going to come out. Go read Agamemnon, because it really is just it'll unnerve you. And Cassandra's monologue is really just chilling.
Yeah.
The whole play just has this air of dread about it, and it's just it gets under my skin. It's so ugh. But Agamemnon was part of the House of Atreides, and there's no good ending if you're from the House of Atreides, has its roots in child cannibalism and eating your own young, literally. So, you know. All right. So anyway, the reason I'm bringing all of that up is not just because this act is very short and we're trying to fill time. It's because the play seems self-consciously to draw from that.
Yeah.
And what Goethe seems to be doing here is playing on the stories of the homecomings. You know, Agamemnon's story, even in the Odyssey, Agamemnon's story is sort of like what you don't want to have happen when you come home.
Yes.
Like in the Odyssey, if you don't remember, Telemachus it begins with Telemachus on a search for his father, and Telemachus goes to talk to Menelaus, and Helen is there, and they have this weird exchange, but lurking in the background is what happened to Agamemnon. And they want to make sure that what happened to Agamemnon is not going to happen to Odysseus. So it's sort of like the warning of what awaits you when you come home. And what appears to be awaiting Helen when she gets back from Troy here is annihilation. I mean, even with that sort of winking, ironic nod, hey, wait, there are no cows here. Like, there's nothing to slaughter.
Yeah.
What's going to happen? Right. So in any way, they begin in this kind of tragic mode, right?
Yeah.
And, then Helen goes upstairs to make sure everything's in order. And who does she run into?
It's the foe, let's see, what is it? The Phocyrus.
The Phorcyad.
Yeah, the Phorcyad, yes, that's it. Yes.
And who is that?
Well, there's a big reveal at the end of the act, Claude. I don't know if we want to spoil it for everybody. No,
this was revealed in the classical Walpurgis Nacht. It's Mephistopheles.
It's Mephistopheles. And so he is Mephistopheles is the kind of monstrous housekeeper who's been supposedly taking care of Menelaus's palace here. And it's this, over the course of sort of Helen being a little shocked at like, the instruction is for me to be sacrificed, and they're, we're all getting ready for that sacrifice, you know? And there's a lot of like, kind of sassy back and forth between, Mephistopheles and, the chambermaids there. But this is kind of the, in the midst of all that, this is all part of Mephistopheles' plan to get Helen to agree to go meet Faust, as he begins describing like, while you were gone, these strangers from out of nowhere came and set up shop in this river valley, upland from Sparta here in these mountains along this stream. No one has ever seen the like of them, but they're led by this great and wonderful prince. And he's definitely won't sacrifice you. I can take you there now.
And well, that's the thing. Like, all right. First of all, before we get too far into it, I do want to point out that when Helen comes back, she has this line, and I'm using David Luke's translation just for ease. It's a good translation. It was the best one to use for me for right now, because it also has really good notes, and the notes that I was or the background information, a lot of that I was telling at the beginning sort of comes from his introduction. It's a good introduction if you're looking to understand the text. The background and the context, I would go with this one. But anyway, she has this line. She says, "I am a prize of war, perhaps a prisoner, for by heaven's will, my reputation is two-edged, as is my fate. And both the ambiguous followers of beauty even now beset me with their dark and menacing presence on this threshold of my home." There's something she keeps articulating about how dangerous beauty is.
Mm-hmm.
And this gets at something that Goethe apparently was working at in this act. Is Faust finally mature enough to handle it?
Yeah.
Is he mature enough to handle beauty? And that sort of seems to be the argument that at this point he is. But what is the outcome? The outcome seems to be tragic.
Mm-hmm.
Even if he is ready, it seems as if not everyone else is ready, and bad things seem to come of beauty. Either that or of necessity, one age will transform the aesthetics of another age and take it out of that so that it cannot last. There's something in this act which is having to do with the failures of classicism.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's not quite clear to me yet what exactly the play is saying about that, but we can discuss that later. I just wanted to sort of bring that up because it happens sort of right off the bat that Helen is speaking of beauty, and I think we can use this as a kind of metaphor as well for aesthetic beauty,
mm-hmm.
right? But she's speaking of her beauty as both enticing and dangerous. And we sort of need to see how that plays out.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Mephistopheles. Well, okay. So he's the Phorkyid, right?
Yeah.
And once again, and you're bringing up the back and forth with the girls. That's another part of the structure as well. I just want to point that mm-hmm. out, that the maidens who come back with Helen are the chorus.
Yeah.
And they even have a chorus leader. And so the chorus is sort of playing this part here, you know, doing what a chorus does, sort of telling us how to interpret the action and what to think about it.
Yeah.
So it's really kind of fun. Mephistopheles is having this kind of back and forth with the chorus. And it also seemed to be reminiscent of him sort of messing around with the Thessalian witches in the classical of Walpurgisnacht. There's this way in which he was trying to do something similar, except here it's more antagonistic, I think, on his part. But be that as it may, it was striking to me how when he appears sort of from the beginning, he brings a kind of moralistic language into it. And again, this is the Luke translation. He says, "The proverb's old, but still its meaning's high and true, that modesty and beauty never hand in hand pursue their way together along the earth's green path.
Mm-hmm.
Between the two, ancient deep-rooted hatred dwells, so that wherever they may somehow chance to meet, each of them turns her back upon her enemy. Each will press on, then further, with more vehement pace, modesty, sadly, beauty flown with insolence, till in the end hell's hollow night receives them both. If they are not first subjugated by old age, thus now, you foreign hussies, shameless, arrogant as you are, I find you swarming hither like a horse in noisy flight of cranes, which in a straggling cloud above our heads sends down its harsh cacophony on us, so that the peaceful wayfarers move to glance aloft, but off they fly upon their way while he goes his, and so it shall be between us." this is Mephistopheles with all of his, you know, sort of trenchant irony, but it's also Mephistopheles as moralist.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the things we sort of talked about in the classical Walpurgisnacht. Part of what it seems that antiquity, or part of what it seems that Goethe was attracted to with antiquity, was this lack of moralizing. You know, it's not that classical tragedy doesn't have a point of view and is not working as a kind of rhetorical agent trying to persuade you of some particular idea of justice or of this or of that or what have you. But it seems to be just the sort of willy-nilly free-for-all mm-hmm. of admission of all kinds of human behavior that drew Goethe to the writings of antiquity.
Yeah.
Here's the northern devil, right?
Yeah.
Because Mephistopheles is unacquainted with the classics, but here's the northern devil, and he can't help but moralize. I mean, this is really kind of simple stuff. Modesty and beauty never have anything to do with each other. And that's just sort of typical, you know, satirical moralizing that goes back to the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm.
Even further, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's sort of his tone here and his take here, which is kind of, I don't know if it's intended to be jarring, but it does seem like weirdly out of place if we're thinking of this as a thematic link.
Yeah. Helen, of course, you know, if the choice is between being a literal lamb at the slaughter or not, agrees to meet this new mysterious lord. And again, like you said, in the space of a couple of lines, it's like, you know, the smoke machine gets turned on the stage that this is being performed on, ostensibly. and we arrive. I just as an aside, I think it's amazing that there are still stage directions at this point in the play. Because, like, there's no way on Earth, there's no way on God's green Earth anyone actually staged the classical Walpurgis Nacht to get to Act 3. Anyway, so Helen and her coterie of maids appear in this hall, and it's like a medieval hall. It's like it's hung with coats of arms, and this, you know, this noble princely fellow descends the stairs, and it's Faust. Who was apparently made up as a sort of grandee, a kind of idealized feudal duke, who, you know, these people have just appeared in his castle. Well, you know, he then seizes the watchman who was supposed to warn him of people approaching the castle to castigate him in front of these people, including the captivating Helen, who he then, you know, he turns this watchman over to Helen's judgment. They're like, all right, what should I do with this guy? You know, and Helen, of course, shows mercy. You know, as far as she knows, like, well, we just appeared here in a puff of smoke. It's not this guy's fault.
Yeah.
And then Faust goes on at great length about Helen's noble beauty and pledges his life to her. And it's kind of like, I guess this was almost like a variant of courtly romance, I guess. The kind of like pledging your fealty to a lady at first sight, courtly love angle, like the troubadours would sing about.
And even into the sort of the chivalric romances that Don Quixote was so fond of.
Yes,
you know, so he's moving from genre to genre.
Yes.
And incorporating several genres and several verse forms associated with those genres.
And it is
like all throughout it.
Yeah, it is. It is in the midst of this that there are explosions and alarms going up that Menelaus is approaching into the Middle Ages somehow. And I got the impression I got was that what had happened is that Mephistopheles had just plonked down like a Rhinish castle in the middle of Lacedaemonia. There next to Sparta, or was Helen removed to an idealized, you know, Palatinate? I have no idea. But the fact that Menelaus was able to get there and also has like gunpowder weapons, I mean, it's some seriously crazy stuff.
Did you ever see the Simpsons episode? Well, of course you did, but there was that Simpsons episode where Rodney Dangerfield was the guest host and he was Mr. Burns' heir.
Yeah.
He was Mr. Burns' son. And at the end, they fake a kidnapping and it all goes weird, but everything turns out okay. And suddenly there's just a giant party happening.
Yeah.
And Marge says, wait a minute, where'd you get that drink? Says, who cares, Mars? It's Marge. It's a party.
That's
sort of how you approach Faust Part 2. You know, who cares? It's a party.
Yeah.
Just go with
it. And speaking to the nationalist angle that you brought up earlier, as Menelaus's men are approaching, Faust rallies his bannermen and calls them out as like, you Saxons shall deploy here, you Franks here, you Goths here. These are all, of course, the classical quote unquote, this is a very problematic category to put people in, Germanic barbarians. So I thought that was interesting because, of course, this is in the, you know, Goethe's lifespan spans the dissolution of the Holy Roman Empire, which was, you know, by his day, a total fiction of any kind of unitary Germanic state. But he also, this is all well before the actual eventual unification of Germany under Kaiser Wilhelm I of Prussia and Otto von Bismarck later in the century. So I thought it was very interesting that there's still this kind of like, he's still harping this, this kind of proto-pan-Germanic national character of the few of this Middle Ages society.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
No, it totally is. I mean, that's what he's going for here. And this is the tough part, because that seems to be one of those moments of unity, of everything coming together, mm-hmm. but it can't last. I mean, nothing in this act does. Well, I mean, nothing in this play does, but because everything is transformed again and again and again, and this act ends in transformation.
Yes.
But I want to go back for a second to think about Mephistopheles. I can't get him out of my mind. No, but Mephistopheles again is acting the part of the pimp.
Yes.
Like he, you know, all the way back.
If the procurer. Any kind of,
yeah. If you're looking for any kind of thematic unity, or I guess, okay, not the pimp. He's the pander.
Yes. Sorry, yes.
Two different things. But if you're looking for any kind of thematic unity, that seems to be, you know, a link back to Faust Part One. And you cannot read these things as, you know, tightly structured interconnectedness. I mean, you can't read Faust Part One as tightly structured, but this does seem to be a sort of thematic echo of Mephistopheles as Pander, as the go-between, mm-hmm. as the one who will get Faust the girl. And something interesting goes on between Mephistopheles and Helen. He uses language to, not only is he being moralistic, he's using language to affect her mind. She says, "In sorrow, not in anger, I must intervene. I must forbid this altercation's violence." Mephistopheles, as Phorcus, has been sort of bickering back and forth with the chorus, and Helen's putting a stop to it. She says, "Nothing does greater injury to a prince than if his loyal servants itch with hidden mutual strife, for his commands then can no longer echo back harmoniously, translated swiftly into deeds. Instead, disordered noise roars round him waywardly, while in confusion he upbraids the empty air. Nor is this all. In your unseemly anger, you called dreadful shapes to mind and dismal images which throng about me, around me, so that I myself feel drawn down hellwards, even on this my green and native earth. Is it a memory? Has delusion seized my mind? Was I all that, and am I? And shall I still be that nightmare image, Helena, the city's bane? The girls all tremble, you alone, the eldest, stand calm and composed. Now show me wisdom in your words." The bickering, the back and forth, calls to mind the destruction of Troy and her own sort of culpability in that. But we also have that moment of antiquity that is not streamlined beauty, but real horror.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it seems to be the other side of this that's always waiting, right? And Mephistopheles keeps reminding her and guilting her. And again, that doesn't, you know, if there is no sin in antiquity,
right,
then there can't be guilt.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
But Mephistopheles is working on her. They have this back and forth, and she says, "When do you call to mind that semi-widowhood, and or why do you call to mind that semi-widowhood and the appalling ruin that it spelled for me?" Phorcus says, "I suffered by that voyage too, freeborn in Crete. It brought me long imprisonment and slavery." Okay, the things that you did had this repercussion on me.
Yeah.
Helen says, "You were brought back at once to keep his household here. His castle and its hard-won wealth became your trust." Mephistopheles says, "You left them both to seek the towered walls of Troy and to enjoy love's pleasures inexhaustibly." She says, "Do not speak of the pleasures. An infinitude of bitter sorrow overwhelmed my heart and mind." but he keeps going on.
Right.
He's guilting her.
Yeah.
And really sort of working on her to feel that kind of dread, that there's guilt, there's dread that, you know, what's going to happen to her is justified in some way, and that there's no other out than to go find Faust.
Yeah. So this is the union of post-feudal Europe and the classical world we've been hearing so much about. It's not bringing the best of classical world. It's applying Protestantism onto the classical world.
Well, that's what I thought was really kind of interesting. Like, that's why I see a lot of ambivalence here. All right, on the one hand, you know, there's this idea of taking the best of the past with the best of the present and putting it together. But what about the worst of the present?
Yeah.
And the worst of the past.
Right.
You know, that also seems to be at play.
Well, I'll tell you, like, what. See, now you mentioned that, and I know exactly what that gets you. That gets you the American South during chattel slavery.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly – they were very, very conscientious about the fact that they were attempting to – or they believed themselves to be emulating – the great slaveholding societies of Rome and Greece. And of course, there were also through and through Protestants. Wow. All right. I'm discovering this as I say it. we discovered in real life what that would mean. Woo. All right. Anyway.
You know, I worked for years to escape the South, and it always just catches up with me.
Well, buddy, I'm still here deep in the bosom of the South, so I'll never let you forget about it. and no offense to all of our Southern listeners, I think you all know what we're talking about.
Yeah, hating where you're from is a genuine Southern attitude.
hating where you're from, and also being, you know, sticking up for it however also, you can.
Yeah, having to love it at the same time.
Yeah.
Anyway, I will not give up saying the word y'all until I'm dead in the ground. Mm-mm. Because it is a goddamn.
It is just word. So grammatically useful. I just it's love it. Anyway.
You're right. You're right. And that's kind of the strangeness of this. The first merging, you know, that's actually in my notes, the first merging of antiquity and sort of modern Europeanness is when Mephistopheles introduces guilt to Helen.
Yeah.
So that puts us in such a weird position. That's kind of what he can offer, and that's what he can do, that kind of prodding, nagging, you know, angst. So that's what gets her there. But once she's there, she finds something different. So they do have this, the running... Like one of the running themes that I think we've been talking about is spectacle. Like so much of this play has to do with spectacle and the production of spectacle, the producing of phantoms or phantasms. And when Faust appears with the watchman who didn't tell him that Helen was here, they have this weird performance where Faust makes a spectacle of his own devotion to beauty. Like he threatens to kill the watchman who didn't alert him as this kind of, oh, glorious lady, this man must be killed because he did not tell me of your coming.
Yes.
And it's really sort of over the top and overwrought and kind of ridiculous, but it's that performance of the appreciation of beauty, you know?
Yeah.
That seemed to be for her benefit and no one else's. And I can't quite tell if the guard is going along with it or if this really is sincere in some way, shape, or form, if we can even think about anything in this play being sincere. You know?
Yeah.
But she does have this moment where she recognizes how pitiable he is. Or how pitiable this night watchman is. And she again notes the way that her beauty can drive people nuts. Right. Is Faust's lenience towards the Watchmen also a performance of his so-called maturity, that he will not be driven out of his mind to destructive things because of Helen's beauty? I'm wondering if that's another way to interpret that.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really matter. Helen is enchanted because people here speak in rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that I wish my German was decent enough to read the original. I can ask where the toilet is and I could order a beer, but I can't really read Goethe.
Yeah.
But the novelty of going to the palace is that people start speaking in a different verse form.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what enchants Helen is the rhyme. Classical poetry, ancient poetry in Greek doesn't rhyme.
Yeah. That's not an element that's not an element of the rhythm. That's not an element of the mnemonic properties of it. Mm-hmm. It's purely, it's purely rhythm and kind of, stock phrases or stock descriptors, I guess in the Homeric, tradition anyway.
So, she begins picking up on the rhyme and starts rhyming with him. And so they have this kind of duet as they take their thrones together. So I think the intention is to sort of be like Romeo and Juliet, who are completing each other's lines and things like that. They're completing each other's rhymes and sort of playing in that manner. Then we have the defense against Menelaus, who's got guns for some reason.
Yes. Yes, which I really loved. This was I don't know. There's just something about it that struck me as kind of almost like Michael Moorcockian. Like the idea of Homer's characters having like blunderbusses and brass cannons.
If the angels in heaven during the fall of Satan had them.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I don't know if I've I think I posted about it on the internet before, but I don't know if we've talked about it. But there's this fascinating phenomenon. I'm sorry to get tangential, but we're talking about firearms and angels. The New World schools of courtly painting in the Spanish Empire. I think we may have talked about them on the show when we talked about Don Quixote, but there was this whole tradition of painting the angels as kind of royal guard musketmen. And so they're in these magnificent, like Renaissance, ruffled collar, like slashed sleeves, lanzknecht looking outfits, holding arquebuses with angel wings. And they're just remarkable artworks. They were produced in the viceroyal courts of Peru and Gran Colombia. And just a remarkable artwork. They're actually studios of – there were some indigenous painters. It wasn't just like, white Spaniards who had – emigrated. It became a kind of indigenous tradition. And so for a while, and it may even still be going on, but for a while, some, indigenous, religious artwork would include what were called arquebusier angels.
Huh. Cause there's actually, that reminds me of a poem by the contemporary American poet, Jory Graham. She wrote, I think the title is Angel with a Machine Gun.
Yes.
Maybe it's not. Maybe it's Angel of History. And anyway, it's playing on the idea of the Angel of History and sort of this articulation of it that I believe Walter Benjamin had. But she describes an angel with a machine gun.
Yeah.
And it's this weird, jarring image. But I hadn't really considered it. Maybe it has these resonances with the kind of paintings that you're talking about.
Yeah. But all that to say, sorry, to get us back on track.
Yeah.
Menelaus shows up. It's just strapped to the hill.
Menelaus shows up and he's not really much of a threat. But it's at this moment that Faust really, this is something that I was trying to interpret and this is, again, this is the problem. If we're reading the translation, we can't really pause to interpret word by word, and the resonance of several words, or the resonance or the meanings of certain kinds of words, and the particular usage will elude us. So what we're left with is sort of talking about broad structures. And I'm kind of okay with that, but it leads to some questions. I wish I had the original German for this particular moment. All right, Faust comes close to losing the bargain.
Yeah.
He comes close to losing the bet, because when he sits down with Helen, these are Luke's words, and it's not even just Luke's words. Luke notes that several critics have tried to locate this as a moment where Faust does lose. But he says, "Breathless I seem, words tremble and lose power. This is a dream in no place at no hour." That seems to be a kind of articulation of the end of time and the end of space that Faust said would end up being the concluding term for the bet.
Yeah. Right?
Once he reaches that transcendental state, then the bet's off. But we were sort of talking about that before. The paradox of that is that if he reaches that transcendental state, then there's no possible way for Mephistopheles to get him anyway.
Yeah.
But this is where he comes closest to almost kind of sort of saying that this is it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Mephistopheles interrupts in the guise of Phorcys to say that Menelaus is here. Okay. So here's – this is where I wish I had the original German. One way that I was thinking about interpreting this was that Faust is coming close to concluding that he seems to be on the cusp of giving it up. Mephistopheles is about to win. But instead of taking the victory, it seems to be in Mephistopheles' nature just to keep prodding. Like, he can't stop from provoking.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense. So he's got to be the one who brings Menelaus, or he's got to be the one who brings the news of Menelaus to get Faust up to make this weird declaration with all the other sort of princes of all the German nationalities or the Germanic groups or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
If Mephistopheles really was feeling his stake in this, wouldn't he just stop and let Faust really kind of continue, keep going and hang himself with enough rope? But Mephistopheles just can't help himself.
Yeah.
But to keep prodding, it's just this weird moment. I'm wondering, am I misreading this, or is that sort of how it's working? I'd be curious to know what any of our listeners who know the German,
If there's some nuance that we missed there, but yeah, you're right. It does seem like he's, we've all been guilty of self-sabotage in our time. not even the demons of hell are safe from working at cross purposes with themselves.
It seems like they're more prone to doing so.
Yeah, yeah.
But Faust even recognizes this as an intrusion. He says, "Offensive interruption, insolently it intrudes. I hate such headstrong folly, even when danger speaks." So it's kind of like, man, I was just on the verge of really bringing it all together right. into the oneness of existence. But in any case, They dispense with that, and Faust, now that he's sent his fiefdoms all abroad, sits down with Helen, and bam, we're in Arcadia.
Yep. It's just the scene just dissolves instantly. And here we are some span of time later, very unclear. So we're in Arcadia in a beautiful sacred grove. Here, or maybe not sacred, but it's an enclosed arbor, as it says in the stage notes, because remember, this is a stage play.
Yeah.
But
I always imagine, you know, there was a sorry, this is our dumb reference night, but there was a Mystery Science Theater 3000. It was a line that I think they used in a couple of things, but whenever there was smoke and steam, they'd be down at the bottom going, dry ice and lots of it. That's what I always sort of imagine. Man, if you wanted to get these stage directions right, really perform it right, you'd need lots of dry ice.
Lots of dry ice and a full orchestra. Or at least what was the stage direction here? Yeah, a pleasing, purely melodic music of stringed instruments. From this point to the pause after line 9,938, there is full musical accompaniment. So,
yep.
So,
he goes opera, you know.
Yeah, he goes opera there. But anyway, we're in this this lovely glade, this, you know, Arcadian glen, this idyllic setting, which reminds me a bit of Faust in the Cave. You know, that was described as being this idyllic. There's a lot of callbacks in this scene because we have, it reminds me of Faust in the Cave, and Faust and Helen have now have a child, this miraculous boy child, Euphorion. Which I think anyone can make the etymological connection there between Euphorion and Euphoria. So it's this,
and he's also intended to be the spirit of poetry from the first act.
Yeah. Yeah,
like when Faust was dressed as the miser, and they had the whole pageant spectacle and everything like that, and the joyful boy who is the spirit of poetry sort of flies around, and so on and so forth.
So here we have this joyful boy Euphorion. So Faust has had another child by a woman procured for him by Mephistopheles. There's another callback. And it's magic and flies around, or not really flies around, but it leaps in these great bounds. It's clearly the supernatural figure, much like the jar of ejaculate that was the homunculus in the classical Walpurgis Nacht. So this really, like, I was reading all this and I was like, whoa. This is clearly tying up some threads here. And I couldn't tell you exactly what it means. But, you know, we might be able to work that out tonight. But the scene is set. They're just love. They're glorious, bouncing, literal bouncing baby boy who was leaping from, you know, from treetop to ruined pillar to tree. But Faust makes mention that, like, but don't dare try to fly. Remember, you have to touch the earth, like, and he makes reference to Antaeus, the earth giant who, Hercules, you know, is totally invincible. No challenger could beat him until Hercules came around and discovered that as long as Antaeus had his feet planted on the earth, who was his mother, that he could not be defeated. So, of course, Hercules, in all of his meathead cleverness, just lifts him up over his head, and, you know, that's the end of that guy. So here we have Euphorion leaping, having a great time. Everyone's like, oh, you beautiful boy. And what does he go and do? He pulls an Icarus. He leaps and he tries to fly.
He chases the wildest girl in the bunch.
Yes.
She turns into a sun and explodes off stage.
But thank God for that, that gets to happen off stage. I'm sure the production manager was glad they didn't have to stage that also.
And so he leaps into that and explodes and falls and dies.
Yep.
All off stage. But this is our ejaculatory ending. Orgasmic ejaculatory ending.
Which is also the death of a child born by the union of Faust and a woman procured for him.
The perfection of womanly beauty.
Yeah.
So it's a recycling of all this stuff, and it's supposed to be the merger of antiquity with the sort of, you know, best of modernity. The difference between the cave and this, not trying to be gross, but Faust isn't masturbating here. He's actually having sex with the ideal, I suppose.
Yeah.
And the production, you know, at least gets to jump around a little bit. Not much goes on, but all right, it's weird. All right. First of all, not only is Euphoria in the spirit of poetry, but he's Byron. After, you know, when Goethe heard I believe this was already being sketched out, but when Goethe heard that Byron had died, he shifted this and made it a little bit more explicitly about Byron. And so the lament at the end is intended to be a lament for Byron.
Yeah.
And I guess now I have to go into a tangent on Byron. All right. Byron, I think, is sort of ironically scorned in most academic circles these days. I kind of like his work. It's a little bit uneven, mm-hmm. but really the grand masterpiece was Don Juan. And I know it's Don Juan. He pronounced it Juan. He knew right. Spanish.
Yeah.
He spoke Spanish. He read Spanish, but still his Anglicisms are there, and he rhymes it Juan. He rhymes it with things like new one.
Right. So, right. So it's clear from the text of how he's saying it. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think we talked about this a little bit before when we were doing Paradox Lost.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole gist of Don Juan is that it's sort of this, if we can free ourselves from our sexual hangups, we can free ourselves from other sorts of systems of authoritarian structure. As the work goes on, it doesn't play out that way, and it becomes a little bit more stoic.
Yeah.
But anyway, Byron was this, it's hard to get a handle on how huge he was in the 19th century, like, or in the late 18th, early 19th century, and how much of a shadow he cast over the rest of the 19th century, not just in writing in English, but he was kind of an international phenomenon. Byron, and here's, okay, it's October and we can get spooky and creepy with it and kind of creepy and fun with it. And so Byron's kind of the perfect goth kid to play with that. He wasn't supposed to be a lord. He was born with a physical deformity. One of his feet, I guess at the time they called it a clubfoot.
Yeah.
But he always had sort of a lifelong limp. And his father only did one good thing for him in his life, which was die while he was young. his father was a horrible, abusive, you know, alcoholic. And he was left with his mother, and they were related down the way, like distant relatives were aristocrats, and his upbringing was really pretty traumatic. Not only was his father dead, they weren't exactly destitute, but they were sort of struggling for money. He had a nanny who apparently sexually abused him.
Huh.
And what happened was this. Okay. He had some distant great uncle who was fighting with his own son. And so in a fit of pique had sort of written him out of the will. And then the uncle died. And before he got a chance to fix the will,
uh-huh.
and the title and the money and the trust and the 200-year-old cellar all went to Byron.
Yes.
The black sheep of the family, nearly disowned guy's son. So from that moment forward, it was like they'd won the lottery, and Byron got this classical, like this classic education. You know, he was sent to these fantastic boarding schools, and he wanted to be a poet. And, you know, that was sort of his life's dream. And he published some sort of sophomoric verse when he was in college, and it got panned. So as soon as he saw the panning, he wrote this poem about how dull and dumb the, you know, Scottish critics were.
Yeah.
And, It really sort of let him loose. Like he became known and he became famous for his dark, gloomy, gothic verse. But where he really excelled was in an 18th century mode of satire.
Mm-hmm.
like the more he was publicly pissed off, the better he could write. And so, I mean, he wrote some just wonderful scathing satire, but he ended up, when he graduated college, he inherited the house essentially. And so if you were a newly minted millionaire with a title to your name and you inherited this, you know, old manor house, what would you do besides drink all the wine in the 200-year-old cellar and have a 1 to 2 year long orgy?
Yes,
that's what he did. And yes, he nearly bankrupted himself. But there was one good thing that came from all this. Was this is a great story, and it's around Halloween time, and I can't not tell it. a gardener found a skull in the yard. Byron's house, his manor house, his mansion had been part of the old monastery lands.
Hmm, yeah.
That, you know, like way back in the day, Henry VIII gave it to, you know, all his buddies.
And yeah, like yeah. That,
and kicked all the monks and nuns off. So, it had been an old monastery, and they figure this was an old monk's skull. So you're kicking around on your property and you find an old monk's skull. What do you do with it? Well, Byron had it taken to town, glossed over, and turned into a drinking cup.
Oh, man. Okay. Oh, boy. That's typically I only reserve that treatment for the skulls of my enemies I've slain in battle, like how the Bulgarian Khan Krum did to the Byzantine Emperor. I believe that was Nikephoros that he did that to. But
yeah.
Other armchair Byzantinists, don't correct me. I'm sure I got all that wrong. But but wow. Yeah, I would not have thought to do that on a lark.
Okay, so he did. Just sent it to town, had it glossed up a little bit, and then kept it as a drinking cup. And nobody would have known anything about it, except he wrote a poem about it and made sure to have it published. So, but the point that I'm trying to make is that Byron was a guy who cultivated that, right?
Yes, yes.
He was, you know, one of those original bad boys who cultivated that image. He most likely, I mean, you can't even call him bisexual. Let's just say pansexual.
Sure.
He apparently had relationships with some of the boys in the boarding school and with male friends in college, if I remember correctly. And then he goes to London because he does have an official position. He, you know, and this I think is something that Goethe maybe could forgive him some of his trespasses for. He was an aristocrat, and you know how Goethe feels about aristocrats. He's kind of on their side.
Yeah, yeah.
But Byron was an aristocrat, and as such, he had an official place in Parliament, and he did use some of his clout and some of his vote to try to pass, you know, laws to, I guess, improve conditions for the working poor. But even though he married and sort of helped engender the woman who basically co-built the first computing system. Go look that up.
Yeah, yeah.
He couldn't keep it in his pants, and he was sleeping around London. And well, Daniel, if you accidentally slept with your half sister, how would you respond when you found out that she was your half sister?
Oh, well,
would you go back for seconds?
Personally, and I mean, and unless I was a figure in myth, I would not. Although it seems like
Byron,
this gentleman thought of himself in those terms.
Well, he tried.
Yeah.
And once that was found out, that was the end of his career in London. He went into self-exile on the continent. And
I got to tell you, man,
really sort of,
you know, that kind of shit doesn't fly unless you're the Macedonian king of Egypt. I mean, unless you're a Ptolemy, people are not going to look the other way, bro.
Yeah, he was good, but he wasn't that good. Anyway, so he ends up sort of gallivanting around Europe and living abroad in exile. And I mean, a lot of it was self-imposed exile. And a lot of it was, again, cultivating an image.
Yes.
Like his best verse is really his funniest verse. But a lot of his verse is sort of cultivating that. I mean, it's sort of like the Jim Morrison Nine Inch Nails, you know, I'm a dark, creepy,
yeah,
scary, tormented soul, and so on and so forth. And it took off. He became sort of like the image, right? Like that was the image. He became that thing that was emulated. And it's so much a part of, like, I guess 18th and 19th or late 18th, you know, Romantic era. Mm-hmm. But you know, more 19th century sensibility.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really, I guess I always say 18th when I think about the Romantics, because I'm also thinking about Wordsworth and Coleridge, but no, Byron was later than Wordsworth and Coleridge. And so he sort of comes after that, but it really is so much a part of not just English writing, but European writing and European culture, the crafting of this dark, gloomy, tormented soul. Right. And Byron, he'd even ripped off Faust. It's October, and if you're in the mood, go check out his closet drama, Manfred, which is all about this guy who did something unspeakable with his sister, who is also a magic wizard who has all these sort of powers, and he's wrestling with his guilt and sin and all this other stuff like that. But it rips off so much of Faust, and it sort of takes from that and turns it into recognizable tropes, right? Except where Faust is really sort of wrestling with a much more Faust Part One is wrestling with a much more recognizable sort of, you know, human activity. Manfred is just one dude spouting off.
Yeah.
But you know, when he was accused of plagiarism, Byron could say, dude, I don't even read German.
Yeah.
But he was hanging out with Percy Shelley, who did, and who had translated parts of Faust.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's this whole weird thing. In any case, to sort of bring it to a close, a lot of Byron's friends were sort of dying off. Shelley died. So many of his companions were sort of dying young. And he got to this stage late in his life. I mean, he I can't remember how old he was. He wasn't old.
Mm-hmm.
But he got to this stage sort of late in his life where he was like, fuck it. it was just, I might as well go out as best I can. And so he went to Greece.
Yes, yes.
And got sort of like a band of mercenaries together and was sort of training them. And he was gonna, I mean, the idea was to fight for Greek independence against the Turkish. And he ended up dying in Greece. He never saw a single fight. He got bit by a mosquito and got it was either yellow fever or malaria.
Yeah, yeah.
But he, you know, if I remember from many, many moons ago in my first romantic lit class, I believe his doctor, like there was this close personal friend, like personal surgeon or personal doctor who was with him, who was involved in the fighting and got shot several times and went and hid out in a cave for a couple of days until everything was over. And he crawled out and managed to survive the whole thing. Byron got a fever and they were bleeding him.
Yeah.
And that apparently is what sort of hastened his demise. So I remember my professor telling us, so let that be a lesson to you. You know, if you ever go to war, make sure that you get shot seven times and that your doctor doesn't bleed you.
I would say though that, dying of malaria, if you go by, the actual statistical causes of death, that is absolutely a soldier's death. Yeah, okay. At that time, like that was how you were going to die if you were in the armed forces. So I think he still counts.
Well, anyway, the point that I'm trying to make is that there are a couple of reasons why Goethe would want to use Byron here, or want to use Byron as the emblem of Euphorion. One is just the sort of cultural reach he had across Europe at the time. He was a bestseller. He was sort of this widely known versifier. And Byron could do a lot in verse. I mean, go read Don Juan.
Yeah.
It's absolutely amazing. The whole thing is so tightly constructed, and it's in these stanzas that are some of the most difficult to write in English because every other line rhymes. It's interconnected rhymes. And the astounding thing, the really shocking thing about Don Juan is how casual and tossed off it feels.
Yeah.
I mean, it feels like the most relaxed, you know, what have you. My favorite line in the whole thing is after Juan and Julia have slept together for the first time. In epics, you always have to have an invocation of the muse. Well, he starts off the next canto, "Hail Muse, etc. We left you in sleeping." And so it's like just brush over all of that. But he had this tremendous stance. He could do a lot with verse. He had this interest in antiquity and the classics. He sort of shared that with Shelley. I believe both of them knew their ancient Greek. I know Shelley did. I'm fairly certain Byron did. But he also died in the cause of Greek independence.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is another reason why Goethe sees him as appropriate to incorporate into this section about trying to revive classicism.
Yeah.
Now, I think you're right that the reference you've got the reference absolutely right to, you know, and thank you for that backstory to keeping your feet on the ground. Right?
Oh yeah, yeah.
The giant that Hercules killed, and there's also a sort of symbolic resonance that Luke sees, where what Goethe through Faust seems to be saying is stay grounded in the material substance, right? This is a kind of aesthetics that he's espousing. Stay grounded in the day and the age, or grounded in your experience. If you try to expand beyond that into this abstraction or this, you know, sort of totalizing vision, then you'll end up sort of lost in the vision, and you'll lose, your feet will come off the ground. I know Goethe wasn't a romantic, but that's a kind of critique that's woven into a lot of British romanticism. And I'm thinking here of something like Percy Shelley's Alastor.
Yeah.
Have you ever read that one?
No, I have not.
It's this weird sort of mythical piece where this sort of poet figure is searching after this sort of imaginative muse type figure, this empowering thing. And it does seem to be, you know, Shelley seems to be in that Goethean mode where desire is a part of the creative project anyway. And when he finds the muse figure, it becomes this sort of weird solipsistic moment. Like, it's so completely lost in the totalizing vision that you're completely cut off from social life and any kind of engagement with anyone around you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there's a tradition of reading Shelley's poem sort of straightforwardly. But when you consider, you know, Shelley the socialist who's trying to foment revolution for equality,
yeah.
The poem is a satire, and it's a satire on that totalizing vision.
Hmm.
It seems as if Goethe is also sort of warning against the totalizing vision or the totalizing visionary moment as dangerous. He's sort of in anti-romantic mode.
Yeah.
So what does Euphorion, Byron, the arch poet, do? Follows his own path to that transcendental vision and then is annihilated in it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
that's orgasm for you, I suppose.
That's right. And we round up act three on another nut being busted.
Yeah. But it doesn't stop there. That's sort of like the, there's a sort of denouement where the chorus, and this is what I found kind of fascinating. The chorus, undergoes a transformation that is reminiscent of Ovid's Metamorphoses. So it seems like this is going to shift us out of the Walpurgisnacht, the classical Walpurgisnacht, classical fantasy, and back into, I guess, the realities of princely life that we left way back in Act One.
Yeah.
Act Four brings us back to Faust and the Emperor.
Aha, yes.
And it's like this whole thing has just been one stage of the journey. So what I found kind of interesting is that all the members of the chorus become plants and animals. So yes. That's what I mean by it's reminiscent of Ovid's Metamorphoses. They sort of transform into the scenery. And it seems to be suggesting that the classical is always there. It's kind of like the given history that becomes the sort of scene for where you are.
Yeah.
Right? And it's always accessible due to that.
Mm-hmm.
But the culmination can't be what it was, right? It's sort of like the given of the history, but the present moment will keep going forward. And that's why I keep thinking about this as having to say something about the failure of classicism and perhaps about the failures or the limitations of Weimar classicism.
Yes.
What Goethe himself had, you know, engaged with. If it was the culmination, well, then why do we have Act Four?
Right.
And I'm not being glib. It's sort of like, you know, if this is the apocalyptic moment, then why do we still have two more acts to go?
Well, you know, it's like you said, like I've not read ahead, so I don't know. But we'll see how Goethe wraps this up. I would anticipate, well, here we go. We can put some money down. I'm gonna make a bet on where Faust Part Two goes. Which, if reading it has taught me anything, I'm a sucker to make the bet that I would know
you're gonna
anything
get this wrong
about where this is gonna go. But I do. So we're gonna head back to more firmer ground. We're gonna get back into kind of the Holy Roman Empire sort of, you know, a fable version of the Holy Roman Empire that we were in before with the Emperor. And thinking on the themes of classicism and its failures or its limitations, we may see an attempt at classicism by other characters than Faust. We might see an attempt by the Emperor and he will be made foolish for doing so. I don't know. I don't know if like the classicism element gets dropped entirely. That would seem weird to me because we have spent a lot of time with it so far in Part Two, but also, you know, I don't know. Maybe the child exploding really was the end of that. But I feel like there's, you know, this has been about Faust's striving. Yeah. And he's clearly like a placeholder character for the intellectual life of, you know, late 18th and early 19th century Germany. Yeah. And so clearly classicism was not done with Germany. You know, during the time Goethe was writing. So I imagine that, you know, I feel like some other kind of symbolic character, like say an emperor of the Germans, might have some dabbling to make in this. I'm very curious to see where it goes though.
No, you're all wrong. They say, fuck it. And let's
go. Well, that tears it.
Is just, yeah, Act Four is a war.
You know what? I'm going to go write my own Faust Part Two, and I'm going to more fully explore these themes than Goethe ever could. From my standpoint as a you know barely German literate person.
But I think you're right, if I remember correctly, that you're never done with a theme in Faust. And so a lot of this does get recycled in some way, shape, or form. And every act has to end with ejaculation. So
that's right.
We'll get there when we get there. But I guess that sort of concludes our thinking through of Act 3 of Faust Part 2. There are some things that are still left hanging. I'm still sort of in the background, like on the back burner, I've got simmering some kind of idea that this is sort of his posthumous, aha, I'm still here kind of thing. Because it does seem so autobiographical, but I'm still not quite certain how to thread that needle or what significance it might play. But that's something I want to keep an eye on. I think you're right that the classicism, that's probably something that we should keep an eye on too. How does it manifest if it does manifest? I know that Act 4 really is the war, and then Act 5 is basically Faust as real estate agent. But it's, you know, how do these notions of merging the best of ages, how do they come together if they come together? I can't recall that they do. It just seems to be a phase, which would say one thing about, you know, where that sort of stands, but we'll get there when we get there. And I just want to see how this stuff recycles. I also want to keep an eye on spectacle. So much of this has had to do with performance and spectacle and just sort of, you know, the illusory nature of the performance itself. So I want to see if that gets picked up as well, you know?
Yeah.
But we'll get there when we get there.
That's so right.
Thank you for a lovely, creepy Act 3 in this cold, dank October evening. And while we're on that, I said it before in the bumper, but if you want to hear us talk about the ghost stories of Ambrose Bierce,
yes,
we did a segment for the Agoraphobia podcast put out by the Agora Network. And that was a whole lot of fun to sort of jump away from Goethe for a second. And I've also got a brief meditation on monsters and the Baroque that is, by the time this drops, that already will have dropped.
Yeah.
So we'll have links to all that in the show notes. And, you know, please go check that stuff out, because we put just as much work into that as we do into this. And it was also a lot of fun to look at some of Old West American ghosts.
It was. And as I've told people, you'll have to listen to find out why Claude says that Ambrose Bierce is to Edgar Allan Poe as the cramps are to the cure. Which is probably my favorite simile or analogy I've heard in a long time.
But it's so apt.
It is. It is.
All right. So anyway, if you want to know more about that, go listen. You can find us online on Facebook, on Twitter. Follow us and enjoy what we do. If you enjoy what we do, go to iTunes or Apple Podcasts or wherever you get this and leave a nice review. And if you don't like what we do, I don't know, don't listen.
It's that easy. We don't make you listen, so you don't have to.
In any case, take care. Have a good spooky season, and we'll be back with Act 4 coming up shortly.